Okay, call, you can call me in order. Roll call.
Committee Chair Peterson.
Here.
Director Banks. Director Gonzalez.
Here.
Chair Wolf.
Here.
We have a forum.
Director Banks had a scheduling problem that he didn't catch, and we're going to have to talk about how to maybe schedule these meetings in a way that it's going to be more convenient for him, but we'll worry about that. And I'm ex officio on every committee, I figured I'd show up.
You are again.
There you go.
Try to get.
Right. Okay, we have a forum. Public comment? No public comments? Director's approval of minutes of the Finance Administration Operations Committee meeting and executive session held on February 15th of 2012. Do I hear a motion to approve?
So moved.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes.
So we.
Go to the executive director here.
Oh, thank you. So we wanted to give you a couple of updates before we get into the meat of the meeting. Next week, we're going to provide an update presentation to the full board on the status of the Move Illinois program. We just wanted to give you a heads up on that. We wanted to make sure that everybody understood kind of where we were with key projects and major procurements that this committee, but the board, we're going to be seeing. But also, I think we have some strategic decisions as well that we need some input from all of you on, you know, timing on some of these major projects and our work with local communities to make sure that we can keep the delivery schedule and kind of where we stand with that. So we're starting an increase in activity on Move Illinois, as you know, and we really want to make sure everyone knows what's coming up and understands kind of critical timing and decision points. So we've planned that for next week. Excuse me. I also wanted to remind everyone that the tri-level bridge will close on Sunday. I know we sent an update out to everyone, but we thought we'd just walk through quickly, just a quick presentation, I guess, for everybody, board members, because I know it's not always easy to understand detours when they're just sent out in a written communication. So we thought we'd walk through that. But we really had a critical decision to make on this particular bridge repair. And as you remember, we did the other portion last year. And what we've ultimately decided to do is to close down the entire bridge for a shorter period of time, as opposed to just closing one lane at a time. And we think that overall, either one of those detours was going to be painful. We were going to either be creating a major choke point with one lane open that ultimately, still very narrow, would have put, I think, workers maybe in harm's way a little bit more, or would have had some safety concerns for some of the workers out there on the road. But also, we think that by closing the entire bridge, we'll actually get the full rehab done more quickly, and we'll be able to move more quickly. We also think there'll be some financial savings for us long term, because we won't have to have a seam down the middle of the pavement there, and those are always places where there's an opportunity for compromise. If you just do one lane at a time, you have to join that up. So, you know, it's not something that we'll be doing every time. I thought Paul could walk through some of the highlights. I think we have some maps, right, to help people understand what exactly we're doing, but we think ultimately this is the best for kind of quality and performance long term. But it will be a challenge, for sure.
So I'll just do a quick overview of this, but I really like this project because it's an example of how the tollway works interdepartmentally to do the right thing. Definitely, like Christy mentioned, the norm is not to take a lane out of service or to close down a bridge when we're working on it. Last year, this is the interchange we're talking about. The big system interchange is right by O'Hare Airport. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot of vehicles going through that bridge on a daily basis. 22,000, I believe, is the ADT, average daily travel on that bridge. Last year, we did this sister bridge, and we did that under a detour. And the reason why we were able to do that so easily is because we didn't have an issue of tolling being impacted when we closed that bridge down. And we were able to do that effectively. And when I was out there during one of the deck that we had, I noticed how the quality of this bridge was like, it was impressive, you know, compared to all the bridges that we've done. You know, I was really impressed with the quality of this bridge. There weren't any hairline cracks or anything in it, and you know, so they completed that job, and they did it. The work went very smoothly, effectively, and efficiently. It's a $13 million job altogether to replace both of these bridges. We did it over 2 years. So they did the one direction last year, and they're working on this one this year. And this is going to impact people from northbound Tri-State who want to get on to westbound 990. So that's the movement that we're impacting. This is the detour route that we evaluated, and this solution was not arrived at very quickly or easily. And we actually worked with all the departments at the tollway, business systems, with Shauna, also the IT department, and ops, because we have plazas involved, and communications has been greatly assisting us in getting the word out. But the contractor kind of mentioned to us, you know, as they were wrapping up work last year, you know, it would be great if we could do this bridge also under a detour. But we didn't consider it when we put these plans out because it involves a potential for a double toll. So here's the detour route. The people who would normally just get on this ramp and go westbound on 990 are now going to continue up, go through the Toohey Toll Plaza right here, loop around at Toohey Avenue, come back, get on the ramp at this point, go through to the Devon Avenue Toll Plaza. So you see the two tolls, and that is really what was the big challenge for us. We know we're going to be inconveniencing our customers. We know we're going to give them adverse travel time. You know, we definitely don't want to add a double toll on top of that. But because 84% of our travelers are utilizing the iPass, it kind of gave us the opportunity. And because it's an electronic system, you know, we work with business systems to figure out, you know, how they could do something in the back room with the data so that, you know, people who went through Devon and then go through Toohey and then immediately after go through Devon, they will just have their Devon toll, their Toohey toll deducted automatically.
Within a certain time frame.
Right.
So you can't get off at Toohey and kind of hang out there and, you know, gamble at the casino or do whatever you would do at Toohey and then, you know, hour and a half later go through Devon and you know, have that consideration. But, you know, for the traffic that is, you know, just traveling through the detour and within a certain duration of time, we can take care of that electronically. Through the manual lanes, we have to do something a little different.
Yes, and that's where we had to work pretty closely with the operations on, you know, how are the toll collectors going to handle this and can they accommodate, you know, this double toll situation and make it so that you know, the people who decide, who are using cash, you know, don't have to be double tolled. And we set up a detour lane for them, and they're going to be able to get a receipt, and they're going to be able to hand that receipt in when they go through the second toll plaza so that they won't be charged again.
So the detour lane is going to be at the Toohey?
Yeah, there is going to be a detour lane through the cash side of the Toohey toll plaza.
Okay.
And the whole detour route is going to be marked with signage. We got to put a lot of signs out there to direct traffic. The March 18th is when we're going to close down this little slip ramp right here that feeds onto this bridge. And then March 19th is when we're going to close down this ramp. So the whole detour is going to be fully in effect on March 19th. And communications has been tremendous in helping us get the word out so that we can inform, you know, all of our customers. We're passing out pound cards, these little information cards, which tell people when it's going to happen and what the detour route is at all the plazas. They also they prepared a fact sheet. It's on our website. That's available for people to get. I believe they send out an email blast to our iPass customers so they know that it's coming. We are putting out portable changeable message signs and signing for this on our dynamic message signs so that people understand that, you know, when it's happening. And there are going to be stickers also at the toll booths themselves that are going to be able to explain what's going on.
Before you do that, I'm sorry, what's actually the distance?
You know what? I'm not sure. I think it's roughly a mile and a half.
Okay.
Or 2 miles. I can get that confirmed. The most compelling reason for doing it this way is if we do it under a stage construction, so we build one half at a time on this bridge, we are going to need to have a joint down the middle of the bridge. And as we experienced this morning with that closure on the southbound tri-state, the joints are the weak spot on all of these structures. So if we can eliminate a joint or if we can do it some other way, we always expect it to us. We figure that eliminating this joint on the structure, we know it's going to increase the life of the structure because that's where water gets through it and that's what really does all the deterioration of our bridges. We figure we're going to eliminate $1 million over the life cycle of this bridge. So we haven't replaced the original decks since 1958 when they were built, so we're going to have to spend less time doing these periodic rehabs on this joint and less money on it. Also, we're cutting the duration of construction down from 7.5 months, or almost 8 months, to 4 months. So we're going to get a lot quicker time frame on this. The quality of the work, as I mentioned, because they get to do it in a single pour rather than two pours, we don't have traffic adjacent to the bridge making it bounce, you know, while the concrete's being poured and while it's setting up. It's going to result in a much better end product. And then the safety aspect of it too. We were never comfortable, because this is a long bridge and because it's going to be cut down to a single lane, you know, what happens when a car breaks down or a truck breaks down on that bridge? How do you get emergency vehicle access? How do you even get a tow truck to it? You know, they have to drive around to the other end of it and back all the way up the bridge. So we feel a lot more comfortable about the detour as far as, you know, the safety aspect of it for both our customers and the workers who are going to be working on this bridge.
But it definitely wasn't something we entered into lightly, because it would probably be an inconvenience either way, obviously, because it would have created one lane there, would have created maybe significant backup on the tri-state, but it's definitely something we thought through.
So you're going to do, I assume, radio and television just before this happens?
We just put out our news release last week, and I know that our first reporters are planning to write about it hopefully this weekend, and we're working to do broadcast interviews as well.
Are you suggesting using our commercial time to create commercials for it?
I'm not sure what I'm suggesting, except I think that most people,
that's the way they get their information.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe most people don't.
Is TUI a state road?
TUI, yes. We coordinated very closely with the Illinois Department of Transportation, also with O'Hare, because we're so close to the airport. So they had to approve this detour also.
Now getting on TUI and then back up and around, it's going to cause congestion there on TUI also.
This detour will cause slow traffic, and you know it will start to create some congestion during the peak periods.
What's your staff, sir? What's your staging on the ramps at TUI, and what's your the signal with TUI and the ramp? And
because
your staging area, how can you?
It's going to be a free movement between those two ramps, so they won't have to bring through any signals.
All right, good, no signals. Okay, good.
But it's definitely, we're putting more traffic at TUI, we know that. However, when that traffic, when congestion is going to be experienced, we have the room to store a lot more vehicles. So we have the cash side of the TUI toll plaza there. That's pretty wide. That has a lot of lane capacity there. The other way, if we would have just, if we would have built it on our stage construction, it would have backed up directly onto the mainline tri-state. And we always are uncomfortable with that because we don't like having high-speed traffic right next to stop traffic.
I mean, it's this kind of discussion, if it could be on a radio call-in or television, something or other. Maybe I'm making too big a deal out of it, but I think if you can explain the reasoning behind it, which is very hard to do in a press release because you don't have the give and take and people aren't asking questions about it.
We'll see what we can do to push it a little more. We did put the release out and, you know, I've had a little bit of coverage. But I think that I have an interview on Friday, don't I? That will be, I think, helpful in talking about, you know, it's about really all of our construction, but we'll try to highlight this in particular to make sure that, you know, people understand what we have, you know, the thought process we went through, and it's certainly going to be painful either way, but we think this is best safety considerations and long-term, you know, financial considerations.
We had originally talked about doing a media briefing for broadcast, which is kind of scheduling down, but we can certainly push that out directly.
Maybe on the day that this actually goes into effect, would they come out? I mean, I'm just trying to think, do they come out with their cameras and take pictures of people tearing their hair out? And if so, could we be standing there explaining?
I think they will. And I think that we had originally thought that having them come out with cameras to show some of the detour route, and how that one particular lane would be shown would be very helpful. So we certainly set up some of those stand-ups.
What time on Sunday was going to affect?
I think it's going to be all signs and that are going up overnight, so I think it's going to be like before the morning rush hour.
On Sunday?
I have to confirm that.
We'll work to push it a little bit more between now and Sunday, because it's certainly now is the time that, frankly, you know, press and, you know, press generally, but certainly television and radio can be most interested. They're not as interested a week and a half out, but when it's right, you know, on the verge of happening. So we will, we'll do a little bit more to push it as well.
We coordinate with our District 15 also?
Yeah.
Police.
The detour is 3.5 miles.
3.5, you got that?
Yeah.
So
thank
you,
Wendy.
Up and back?
Yeah. Yeah, the whole length. So, you know, we don't underestimate the fact that this is something we want to get done as quickly as possible. Or undervalue what we need to do.
Yeah, it is going to be an inconvenience to our customers. We recognize that.
But I think most people that understand why it's happening are okay. I mean, and the hard thing for us is to communicate to people why it's happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, people know the roads need to be repaved, but just why are they sending me this place, and am I going to have to pay two tolls? And, you know, it's the background, which I think you put together extremely well. It's just how do you get people to understand?
Now we have a presentation on compensation and overtime. Mike Stone is going to provide that. We decided to put this together because obviously it's not only the finance committee, this is the finance administration and operations committee, and we thought we could talk through how we set levels of compensation, but also you know, overtime pay and what the trends are for our agency in overtime, how we evaluate whether it's appropriate or not. You know, while there's certainly, we've experienced over the last 4 years a downward trend in both overtime and staffing, which we'll go into, but I think that there are some additional ways and new ways that we can, you know, just make sure that we're, you know, watching, you know, overtime and, you know, generally the levels of compensation that we see our employees making. Overtime, and compensation, frankly, are obviously very important for us because we want to remain competitive. We're a 24/7 operation that has a variety of challenges that we need to deal with. This morning's 294 issue is one such example, but certainly snow removal and cash collection and counting on our system, all of those are issues. So I'll let Mike go into the presentation. We're hoping to have a dialogue here about, you know, additional ideas you have for us. Again, the trend has been a downward one, but we should always, I think, look for, you know, opportunities to gauge whether the funds being spent in this area are appropriate or not.
Thanks, Christy. Good morning, directors. As Christy mentioned, this is an area that we have been tracking for some time, and would appreciate particularly your input on some of the issues that we have been looking at and analysis, and appreciate your input on some of these issues. Just as a matter of background, when we set our compensation and overtime, we look at a number of different factors. First and foremost, of course, is agreements that we have with our unions, our collective bargaining agreements that establish not only wages in some cases, but certain work rules that affect overtime and how that overtime is applied. We also have a system of grades, grades that rank from 1 through 15 and also have a salary and hourly designation. Grade 1 is, in fact, the highest pay. Grade 15 is the lowest pay, and each of those grades have a salary range associated with it. In addition, our process is a process that we do together with Central Management Services, CMS, in determining each position. Each position has a job description associated with that. Part of that job description describes that grade that we we designate that particular job for. And then that process is a communication process with CMS in which we submit our job discrimination, our job descriptions, and they make a determination whether it's a Rutan covered or exempt from that process, and that then becomes fixed until we amend that job description or adopt a new job description. We also, in our looking at compensation over time, do marketplace research. What are others in this industry paying? That can include not only government agencies such as IDOT, but also what the private sector is paying. That's particularly useful for certain functions that that have job equivalents in the private sector. And then, of course, we look to comply with state and federal laws, such as the Fair Labor Standards Act, FALSA. So it's particularly FALSA that impacts our analysis of when and how we pay overtime. As I mentioned, each of those grades has a salary and hourly designation, but it's important to note that just because an individual is designated as salary, that does not mean that they don't receive or earn overtime. The Fair Labor Standards Act is actually a very complex act and has a number of different requirements and analysis and process that you must go through. But the basic terms are that anyone who is a non-exempt employee is entitled to overtime pay at 1.5 times their regular rate of pay for hours worked over 40 hours. Exempt type employees, and this is a very general statement, so I don't want us to rely too much on it because there's a much deeper analysis that goes on. But exempt employees are generally executive, administrative, and professional employees. So if you are an exempt employee, you do not earn overtime. If you are non-exempt, you do earn overtime, whether or not you're designated as a salary employee or not. And part of our process is to periodically look at that, at how we've designated individuals, looking at the nature of their job, whether it's change or salary changes, and applying that analysis under FALSA.
I'm sorry, just roughly, what's the proportion in the categories of who are covered under the second DOT and who are not?
Roughly, all those individuals who are grades 5 and above are considered exempt employees. All employees who are grade 6 through 15 are non-exempt. And I'm sorry, I don't know the exact.
I'm just going to make up 80-20.
I would guess it's probably lower than that, actually.
I think of our whole step lesson, we looked at this for exempt. Now, that doesn't mean necessarily that FALSA would apply, but I think we were at somewhere less than 200.
So it's much less.
Of the total employment were exempt employees, but collective bargaining agreement. We'll have to get back.
I'll give you an exact number, but I think that's my estimate would be somewhere along those lines. Yeah.
Thank you.
So just to frame this discussion, and some reminder of things I think we are all aware of, we have had substantial decrease in our headcount level from a high of 1926 back in 2002. We're down to a budgeted headcount of 1598 for 2012, a headcount that we've held steady for the last couple of years. And just as a reminder, we've been able to achieve those that reduction in headcount thanks to technology such as open road tolling. And other efficiencies, as well as really aggressively maintaining a look on our headcount and attempting to keep those levels relatively low. At the same time, we saw a decreasing trend in our use of overtime. So we haven't been replacing headcount with overtime use, or not completely replacing those. So in 2008, we had as high as $5 million of overtime usage. In 2011, it was down to 3.8 million. So one of those metrics that we look at is the percentage of gross pay. So in 2008, we were as high as 5.6% of gross pay. In 2011, we're down to 4.25% of gross pay. So it's fairly remarkable that we've been able to achieve that at the same time as reducing headcount. Some important statistics that we have there is that overtime costs over that period of time are down 25% from 2008. If we had maintained that staffing levels as of 2008, we would have spent $8 million more annually. So you compare that to our overtime costs, and you would see that we've been able to achieve dramatic savings. And of course, our headcount is down about 9% since 2008 as well.
Mike, excuse me. In what areas are the overtime cost predominantly? What departments? Where do we see the overtime cost? Where does it usually occur? Who determines who gets the overtime? I mean, in that process.
Let me check of the people who are eligible.
Right. Who determines that? How is that determined? And I guess.
Our policies, let me go to the second question first. Our policies require that a supervisor pre-approve overtime. That pre-approval can take some different forms. Sometimes it's a more general pre-approval. Other times it's more specific depending on work needs. And we have certain functions that are more of emergency type situations that may require overtime usage. The primary users of overtime are probably the types of jobs that you would expect.
Primarily, really, where we have frontline, where you have someone, for instance, engineering in the maintenance division, particularly roadway maintenance, largely in the wintertime, for snow removal, but certainly for other needs. And then the other area, really, where we see overtime use in a more standard way is in operations. A little less our toll collectors than anything related to the counting of money or picking up money on our system, because we do have requirements according to the indenture to make those counts and deposits within a certain period of time. So we do have to have, for instance, 6-day work week in that area, and it does reduce the overtime. But then on a case-by-case basis, certainly where there are areas where there are positions that haven't been filled and somebody's picking up extra responsibilities that sometimes necessitate overtime, we're starting to see, not to pick it out in particular, but for instance in procurement, because the procurements are now taking a longer period of time and need more work, we're starting to see some additional overtime there that I haven't necessarily seen as a trend before.
What percentage of the 3.8 or 4 million would be attributed to, or dollar amount wise, would be attributed to emergency or life safety type things?
We can the vast majority, you could say, if by life safety and emergency we're talking about kind of repairs on the road or snow removal,
right?
We'll have to get back. I'd say at least 50%.
I think it'd be much larger.
Okay.
There's a significant amount that's frontline, but then, as far as kind of that cash collection point that I made earlier, I don't know that we would necessarily call that life safety or emergency, but certainly it's a requirement of us that we, collect those funds that are out on the system and deposit them as quickly as possible. So I wouldn't put that in the life safety or emergency category.
Sure.
And the pickup of funds, so what you're really balancing is we have to meet the requirements. Are we going to hire another person and eliminate overtime, and which is more efficient?
Can we answer all of your questions?
Yes.
Well, I thought you were asking a different question than the first one, which is how do you figure out which individual is actually going to be the one that gets
the overtime? Is there?
It's sometimes determined by work rules, including agreements with collective bargaining agreements. It may
people
be the most senior person who's entitled to that overtime, for example. A lot of time it's volunteer, and sometimes it's the same person volunteering over and over again. So that's why you may see a particular individual who has a high overtime, even though it's being offered to a broader group.
Do we cap the overtime to individuals? Is there ever cap?
At this point, we do not necessarily cap it. You know, it's something that we could explore. I would say that it's unusual for us to go. It's definitely outlier situations where we're going over, let's say 15% to 20% of salary, but there are certainly cases where that does happen. But at this point, we haven't said that there is, or haven't given direction that there is a cap. And certainly, I think it would be challenging under existing collective bargaining agreements for union employees to implement something like that, because there are rights that employees have to particular, bidding on overtime and scheduling. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's right.
That kind of goes to a question I was going to ask. Do we think that our collective bargaining agreements that pertain to overtime are really sort of the state of the art?
I think that we, one of the things that we'll be looking at in some of these areas is if there are work rule changes that we can get in our collective bargaining agreements. You know, I will say that when we look at, for the most part, and it's something that we'll be watching, I think, even more closely in the coming year as we continue to strive for that 4% overall operating growth, doing a cost-benefit analysis for every work group on exactly when that tipping point is needing to hire another employee. If you see long-term trends, or is this a short-term need driven by some unusual circumstance like a 21-inch blizzard or something? Or is it something that is a trend and we need to, really think about, is it more appropriate to make some changes or to in the agreements or procedures, or just hire an additional person or two? But as you can see, overall, we've benefited from not hiring, because there are a lot of sunk costs in those first 40 hours of benefits and pension and, that just incremental amount more time, you wouldn't necessarily be able to, even with $20,000 of overtime, you certainly sometimes couldn't hire somebody for that amount.
Speaking of pensions that you raised, does overtime pay help inflate somebody's pension?
It will go into that calculation of how much they earned in the highest 4 years, that 10-year period.
So there's a cost there too on the backside, even though we're not hiring people, but some people are gaining by pension increase with the overtime.
Yes.
Okay.
And there are other front sides as well, of course, benefits that go along with hiring them.
But it is an additional cost that would need to go into the calculation,
right, so
when we're determining the hiring versus overtime.
Right.
So you may not have the additional healthcare expense or the other benefit cost, but it will have an incremental impact on pension.
So I think we've already started highlighting some of the issues that we look at when we start making an analysis of whether it's beneficial for us to continue paying someone overtime versus hiring new staff or looking at other alternatives. One of those things that we do balance is additional staff versus using overtime. We look at whether it's a long-term need or if it's a unique and seasonal work that we are looking at. I think that's particularly true when we look at things like the snow removal team as well. As well as technologies. We wouldn't want to just hire individuals when we know that technology may lead to less overtime or less work going into the future.
So the technology point is one. Obviously, we've seen it in action with electronic toll collection, but also as we continue to year after year discuss an ERP system, that's an area too that I think we would benefit from seeing less manual effort.
Would you like to add that to your annual goals?
ERP? No, I would not. I refuse to allow myself to be evaluated whether or not.
Maybe
the stars, the
stars align.
It just keeps coming up.
Sun doesn't set in the west.
We want so much to happen.
I know, we do.
Maybe in your decade-long goal.
Yeah, that's right.
Another important consideration as we look at this issue is the fact that we are 24/7 operation and the unique challenges that we face because of that. Whether that's the fact that we have to staff certain sites or whether we're responding to winter weather. Important point about the snow removal teams are that they tend to work in 12-hour shifts, and that has proven to be the most useful method of employing that staff. But that, as a result of those 12-hour shifts, can result in overtime usage for those types of employees. And of course, our toll collectors as well are 24/7, 365, which can impact individual toll collectors when an individual calls in sick. That shift still needs to be covered and can result in overtime usage. So we have been able to achieve certain items. In the most recent Teamster agreement, we were able to negotiate a provision that requires all those individuals who have a CDL, a commercial driver's license, to maintain that commercial driver's license. That has an impact on use of overtime because it allows us to spread out that overtime usage among a broader group of people. And therefore, we should start to see the impact of that, where fewer individuals are worth earning such a high percentage of their base pay. Other things that we are looking at are, you know, how we are depositing our cash and those work rules there that Christy mentioned that can result in overtime usage, and other workload changes that may be part of collective bargaining agreements that we're looking at, and whether those can be changed that impact overtime and lead to overtime usage.
So I assume worse than the ERP or whatever it is a trust indenture that there's no way we can change it. I mean, it sounds like such a 1950s rule that you have to have your cash in by X
time. Yes, I do think that, I don't know that we would change the indenture, but I do think we should be, we'll be looking more closely at, you know, our actual performance right now and how much, you know, capacity there is to think about scheduling changes and staggered, you know, weeks and schedules, or whether it's just necessary to hire some additional people there. But it does seem like a 1950s provision, but the cash out